I'm going to talk about the possible clash between the United States and Iran, but within reason, I'm open to discussing anything else that you would like to raise. This date, by the way, which is totally coincidence, it was certainly not planned this way. This is November 4th, as some of you are probably aware. November 4th, for those of us who have worked on Iran over the years, is a tremendously important date. On November 4th in 1978, the Iranian, when the revolution was going on, 77, sorry, when the revolution was going on, students revolted at Tehran University and were brutally put down by the Shah's forces, and it was one of the opening rounds of what proved to be the Iranian Revolution. Then in 1978, the 79 it was, the hostages were actually taken on November 4th. The embassy was taken in Tehran on November 4th that year. And then the following November 4th was the presidential election in which Jimmy Carter was defeated. And, of course, the Iranian Revolution and the hostage crisis was one of the key issues that, in fact, defeated him in that election. So when I have Iranian friends who talk to me about the history of American meddling in Iranian politics, I tell them that they've meddled in American politics, too, because their actions actually had a very significant role in changing presidents. I am going to, as I say, try to be fairly brief and succinct, and I'm going to focus pretty much on things that I think people, the kinds of, you know, what would you really like to know about this country and about this potential crisis. The first thing that I think is really crucial to start with is that Iran is really emerging as the pivot of Middle East politics. It actually is becoming the center of the political world. And the thing that I think gets overlooked a good deal when we think about this is that the reason that it is emerging this way is largely thanks to us. We went in and eliminated Iran's worst enemy, the Taliban, on the east, and thereby removed a direct threat to their national security. Then shortly thereafter, we went in and removed Iran's worst enemy to the west, Saddam Hussein. And then to top it off, we instituted a Shia government for the very first time in the entire history, the millennia of history of Iraq. A Shia government was installed thanks to the United States. And of course, that Shia government, since Iran is the center of Shia Muslim belief, this is a group that is going to be very friendly to the United to Iran, as opposed to the Sunni Ba'athist Arabist group that was there before under Saddam Hussein, which actually, of course, fought a war with Iran, attacked Iran, and fought a war for 8 years. So those three things have changed Iran's position in the Middle East dramatically. Iran today actually is far stronger, in a far better position, and much more influential from a political point of view than it really has ever been, at least since the days of the Shah, when Iran, you may recall, was our best friend in the Middle East. And basically the Shah was acting as a surrogate for the United States and protecting U.S. interests by law, by statute, really, in the United States. So then if you add to that the fact that Iran has also developed very, very close ties with the Hezbollah group in Lebanon, which is Shia also, and which, of course, I think we have the example of the war this last summer, can stir up a lot of trouble in the region when it wants to. And, of course, it did this past summer, started a war. There is a kind of model to think about Hezbollah's role, where, in fact, Hezbollah is often seen strategically as holding Israel hostage, that they have all of these long-range missiles, many of them provided by Iran, which are available there in Lebanon, so that if, for instance, Israel decides one day that it wants to attack Iran for whatever reason, for the nuclear issue or others, potentially Hezbollah provides a ability to counterattack against Israel itself. Basically, Iran today can't reach Israel. Despite all the talk, they really can't do it, but Hezbollah can. And many people argue, and I would be one of them, that one of the principal reasons why Israel's response to the kidnapping of two of its soldiers along the border was so extraordinarily extensive throughout Lebanon was, in fact, because they wanted to destroy Hezbollah as a strategic element that Iran could use. I would argue that they failed in that effort. They made a point about the costs involved, but they didn't really destroy Hezbollah, and some people would argue that Hezbollah today is actually stronger in the Middle East than it was before. But if you put all of that together and you add in the Syrians, who are, after all, ruled by this little group called the Alawites, who are sort of crypto-Shia. Their background comes out of the Shia background. You have what is now commonly referred to as a Shia crescent that starts in Iran, actually starts in Afghanistan, if you like, because the Shia also fall over in the border into Afghanistan, all the way through Iran, which is really the home of Shia domination or political control, and then from there now through Iraq, where a Shia government exists, through Syria, and then on to southern Lebanon, where you have a militia that basically dominates the southern part of the country and is a tremendous political power. All taken together is a remarkable thing. And this has really happened primarily since the United States began its war on terror. And this is one of the things which we have, in fact, helped create. And it clearly, I actually asked Ambassador Nick Burns, who is the Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs and who is, in reality, the Iranian desk officer in the State Department. He's the guy who manages Iranian affairs, and he was speaking in New York the other day, and I had an opportunity to ask him a question, and my question was, you know, you're talking about Iran's threat and all of these things that have come up in the last few years, but wasn't that really our fault? I mean, didn't we do that for them? And he heard me out, and he said, well, we didn't mean to. And I think that says a lot, because I agree, we didn't mean to. It was, just as the British Empire was created in a fit of absent-mindedness, we had, in a fit of absent-mindedness, created what could be this seen as this Shia uprising, Shia threat that is emerging. And that is something that I think is very much on the minds of our old allies in the region, the Sunni governments, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Egypt. They're very concerned about this because they live in the region and they have seen this emergence, this revival of Shia political influence in the region. And in fact, there are, in typical Middle East style, there are lots of conspiracy theories. And one of the conspiracy theories is that the United States really wanted to get rid of all of our old Arab allies and replace them with Iran and the Shia for some reason. It was a little difficult to come up with the reason, but the fact that we did it gives a certain logic to the conspiracy theory. But the main reason that people are concerned about Iran right now is because of the nuclear issue, and for that reason, I'm going to focus primarily on that. First of all, let's just start by asking, what is it that Iran really wants? I mean, why are they developing this nuclear infrastructure that they are building? I'm not going to go into a lot of detail about it, but the reality is that Iran produces something like 4 million barrels a day of oil, give or take a little bit. They use presently 1.5 million barrels of that oil for their own internal uses, for fuel and for generating electricity. And with a growing population, and it's growing very rapidly, Iran is using more and more of those of that fuel for its internal purposes. If they sold that 1.5 million barrels on the international market, they would get something like $60 to $70 a barrel for it, the way prices are currently. If they use it internally, everything is subsidized. They have very, very 9 cents a liter for gasoline, for instance, which is we haven't seen anything in this country of that price for 50 years. And so everything is subsidized. So they get almost nothing. In fact, they probably that actually costs them money because they're giving it away for all practical purposes. So there's a huge gap there that they would like to fulfill, that they would like to fill. And part of the reason that they're going for nuclear power is not a joke. It actually is that they're diversifying their resources. They also are experimenting a lot with solar and wind and biomass. They are the biggest dam-building country in the world, practically. They build dams on anything where there's a little trickle of water running and use it to create hydroelectric power. And they are doing it all over the country. So it's not that they're not doing other things. They are, in fact. But the problem is, as all of you are aware, that the same process that lets you develop nuclear power also gives you potentially the capability to go for a nuclear weapon. And that is where the problem comes, because how can you tell when it's one thing or another? It's worth remembering that Iran basically has said that it wants to go for an independent nuclear fuel cycle, which includes enrichment as part of the complete cycle. And that is something which actually today there are something like 40 countries in the world that have a full nuclear fuel cycle and who, if they wished, could in fact use that to build a nuclear weapon. We live with that every single day. Some people have said, especially after the recent North Korean nuclear test, there's a thought about Japan might now decide that they wanted to have a nuclear weapon after all this time. And most people, the experts that I talk to, and I'm not one of them in terms of nuclear capability, say that basically Japan would need sort of a long weekend to produce a nuclear weapon, that they've got everything they could possibly need. Other countries also have that capability. It would not be a long weekend, but if they decided to go for it, they could have it rather quickly. Countries like Taiwan or South Africa or Brazil, there are countries all over the world that have this capability. Not only that, but there are like 50 countries that have highly enriched uranium. This is not the stuff that is used to fuel energy plants. This is the stuff that you use to build bombs with. There's enough highly enriched uranium stored in 50 countries around the world that would be capable of building 300,000 nuclear weapons. So this kind of proliferation already exists. It's around us all the time. And the fact is that what Iran is saying, whether you like it or not, is that they would like to be a member of that club. They would like to also have that capability, and I think that's really what they're aiming at this point, is to have that capability, which you can then use for negotiation. You can use that for leverage. You can say, if you don't treat me right, I'm going to build a bomb. And that's much more effective than actually saying, I've got a bomb, and now come and get it. So I have a feeling that Iran is actually going for having that latent capability, which it could then turn into a bomb if necessary, and use that. At least they would be much smarter to do it that way than to actually secretly build a bomb. So are they actually building a bomb right now? The director of national intelligence, Mr. Negroponte, has testified very recently that they are not. That, in fact, if Iran decided to go for a bomb, it would take them 5 to 10 years to actually construct one. That analysis is shared in various ways by Israeli intelligence, would make it sort of 3 to 5 instead of 5 to 10, and, say, German intelligence, which it says would take at least 10 years for Iran to build a bomb. So I think the key point here is that our newspapers and commentators and government officials are making this sound like we're in the midst of an imminent crisis, that this is something that is going to happen right now. The reality is it's a problem, but it's not a crisis. This is something which we've got time to deal with, and it seems to me we ought to be thinking about how we deal with it over time rather than treating it as something that we've got to do right this minute. One of the arguments that's often made is that there's a point of no return, that once Iran gets to a certain point, you can't turn them back. There's no possibility. Actually, speaking from a purely technical point of view, they've already passed that point. And so they already know enough that they could go ahead on their own and build a nuclear weapon. So that point has already happened, and we can't, in fact, make the clock go backwards. There's no way to take that knowledge away from them and make them suddenly become more stupid than they really are. With that in mind, and the fact that there are some unanswered questions here about where Iran is and what it's likely to do over the next few years, it's really worth asking, who's in charge of this process? And particularly, that's an important question right now in people's minds, because we just had Mr. Ahmadinejad, who's been in office now a little over a year, came to New York for the UN General Assembly meeting. It was kind of interesting to me as a New Yorker, first of all, but secondly, as just an observer, to realize that we had, there was more than 100 heads of state who showed up in New York and made speeches and all. And this guy dominated the news absolutely from the time he arrived until the time he left. And George Bush got a little coverage on one day when he was there and then disappeared off the page again, and it was Ahmadinejad all the way, which this was not, by the way, an accident. He went out of his way to meet with every radio and television show in existence. There was nobody that he didn't contact at one point. And he actually set up shop in one of the hotels in the east side in New York, not very far from the UN. And for a couple of days, he didn't really go out of his hotel. He just had herds of people coming in, one after another, and he was just talking to them, one after another, on camera and otherwise. I was the beneficiary of that. On one of the mornings, he invited a group of about 20 academics and a group of perhaps the same number of senior media types, the editor of The Nation, the editor of Time Magazine, one of the top commentators on CNN, et cetera, all around the room. And he gave us 2 solid hours of his time. He made some opening comments, which I think were probably the shortest I've ever heard from any head of state. It must have been about 30 seconds. He sort of said, "Hello, I think you know who I am. Why don't we have some questions?" And that was sort of it. And we did. And people asked him everything that they could. The media people were fairly shy because they were planning to have interviews with him on the air, and they didn't want to mess anything up. And so they were pretty nice to him. They threw him some softballs, pretty much. Some of the rest of us were a little more adventurous than that and asked some hard questions. I'm certainly not going to go through all of what happened at the meeting, other than just to say that my own take on this is that here's a guy who is very feisty. He loves to debate. That, in fact, he was much more interested in debating than he was in discussing. That basically he got asked a lot of questions, and what he really wanted was to have a snappy reply, you know, that he could sort of throw it back in your face to sort of turn it around and use it against you. But he wasn't really interested in sort of pondering the question and thinking about it and then thinking about how you discuss this and coming out with some kind of a conclusion. And I think that's unfortunate, but I think it's very much part of his character. And when he couldn't think of a snappy reply, he would do his best and then keep coming back to the question as time went on and he thought of other things that he should have said the first time around. But it was kind of interesting to watch him in operation. Another interesting thing that happened during the time he was there is that the Iranian top negotiator on the nuclear issue was holding conversations with Mr. Solana in Europe during the same period of time. And while he was there, he got to the point where Mr. Larijani needed to refresh, he needed to get new instructions from home. And it really was very telling as far as I was concerned, because Ahmadinejad was in New York. So did Mr. Larijani pick up and fly to New York and ask Ahmadinejad, you know, what should I do now in these conversations? Didn't even think about it. He went back to Tehran and asked the people who actually make decisions about these things. And he got his new instructions and went back to Europe. And then later, Mr. Ahmadinejad announced what the new instructions, in effect, said. But he wasn't even involved in the decision. And I think that said a great deal about where he is in the process. The other one thing that I would stress is that Ahmadinejad is, in fact, a populist. He appeals to a particular group of people. And you've got to think about how this guy came into office. He came in running on a domestic platform, not a foreign policy platform, where he was promising a lot of people a lot of things in the course of the campaign. He portrayed himself as a straight-talking guy. I say what I mean, and I mean what I say. He came in with almost no experience whatsoever in foreign policy. He had scarcely been out of the country, actually, in his whole previous career. He relies primarily on a conservative religious base, and those are the people who supported him, and that's where he came from. That is his base, and it's the one that he continues to promote. And he travels around the country and talks to these people in all of the different provinces, unlike any other president in Iranian modern history, and keeps that base alive and well. And that's where he draws his primary support. He identifies himself, if you want to say call it that, as a sort of born-again Muslim. He comes from a very special brand of Islam in which he holds almost folk views as opposed to the sort of what the classic traditions of Islam really are. And he believes very firmly, for instance, in the second coming of the Mahdi, which is, I won't go into an explanation, but you get the idea. If any of this sounded familiar to you, I think it actually is, it's really quite interesting to think of this political leader in terms that we would understand in our own culture and our own approach. And I don't draw that implicit comparison, to make it sound as if everything can be resolved. Actually, that kind of similarity is very dangerous. And I think if you have people who are coming out of two very different traditions and operating according to very similar concepts, that they really have a very hard time coming to any kind of a conclusion. And that is, unfortunately, the conclusion that I draw. The other question that I think people are most interested in is the United States going to attack Iran? I think that is putting it about as simply as I know how. There has been a boomlet of talk about this, especially recently, actually in the last year or two, but especially recently. Time magazine over a month ago ran a very alarmist story saying that U.S. Navy ships had been given given orders to prepare to deploy to the Persian Gulf on or around the 1st of October. And they did, in fact, leave a few days after that. It was the Eisenhower battle group, the Eisenhower carrier with its surrounding battle group. And the Eisenhower has been under rehab for a better part of, I think, 2 years. And so this was its first voyage out after the rehab was finished. And they were actually being ordered to leave a little earlier. They thought they were going to have another 6 months of getting in shape before they went out. But in fact, this speeded it up. That set off a whole set of theories. People did a time analysis and realized that this group could in fact arrive in the Persian Gulf on the 21st of October, and that therefore maybe this group was going to come in and lead a strike against Iran. And there was a lot of talk about this, especially on the web and the like. What they didn't pay attention to was the fact that there was another carrier task group in the region that was being relieved. And you have to send one over to get another one to come back. And this other one was already there. Now, you would have two carrier task forces at the same time in the region as they got to the turnover point, which, in fact, if you were going to launch a strike, that wouldn't be a bad time to do it, because you would have twice as much capability as you would have otherwise. So this was not entirely pie in the sky. They also ran an exercise after they got there. This had been planned a long time in advance, but for 2 days last week, they ran an exercise on interdicting shipping to Iran. And again, that looks like you're asking for, getting something started here. The 2 days went by. I don't think most Americans were aware of when it started and when it ended, but there was a lot of stuff on the internet, and the bloggers were going crazy over this. And then you had people like Scott Ritter, who's been going around making speeches, and Darius, I would say, here's somebody who does make his living as a speaker. There are people who can do that. But Scott Ritter, as you'll recall, was one of the inspectors in the looking for weapons of mass destruction in Iraq prior to the war. And he has since become a huge critic of the U.S. government, and basically he's been arguing quite openly that the strike has already begun, that we have troops on the ground, small guerrilla operations going on inside Iran. They're gathering intelligence, preparing the battlefield, and that the strike is coming. It's just a matter of time, and it's not a very long period of time before this happens. He's been appearing, at least he appeared in New York recently, on the same platform with Seymour Hersh, who has been writing for the New Yorker stories about the fact that American senior military officials are also raising the alarm, saying that the administration is getting ready to launch a strike against Iran, and what a terrible thing this would be. And Cy Hersh has been reporting this. I think he's written three major articles on this subject in the last 18 months and helped start this movement. So there's a lot of intense feeling out there right now that this is something that is just about to happen. I don't believe it. And so maybe I should explain myself, because there are a bunch of smart, knowledgeable people who do think that this is very likely to happen. And I think it's important to think about how and why it might not happen. I guess I would have to start with the fact that I talked to Cy Hersh a lot. I mean, he is somebody that I've known him, and he's known me for a long time, and he knows that I have a different perspective. So usually, not before he publishes his article, but afterwards, he calls me and says, what do you say now? and I usually say the same thing I said the last time. But we have this sort of running joke, and his end line, after I go through all of my litany of why I don't think so, he says, oh, Gary, you're just being rational. He would argue, and there are people that would argue, that with this administration, That is a damning comment, that you're simply not willing to look at reality. I would argue that it is reality, and that this administration, for all of the bluster that is built around it and the hyperbole, in fact, have a very clear sense, not so much of their concern about what happens to people over there, but what happens to them and what happens to this administration. And I would argue that if you really wanted to, in effect, bring down this administration completely and perhaps destroy the Republican Party for the foreseeable future, a unilateral, unexplained attack on Iran at a time like this, with the situation being the way it is in Iraq, would just about do it. Because actually, if you just look at what is required, people talk as if we can just sort of turn a switch and somehow wipe out all of Iran's nuclear capability. It's just not true. The people who have actually looked at it have figured out that there's anywhere between 500 to 1,500 targets that you would have to hit, depending on how thorough you were. And that includes not just places where nuclear capability, nuclear factories and things are buried, or places for centrifuges to operate, but you also have to talk about air defenses and the troops that defend those, and et cetera, et cetera. And then that begins to spread out. And you would also, along the way, like to get rid of the government. That means striking the headquarters of the various places. And if you think about it, that's very much the theory of what Israel went in to do in Lebanon this summer. They were, and I had very good friends who work on Israeli strategy, who told me in advance of the war, the Israeli attack, and then after it began, that they were going to wipe Hezbollah out completely. It was going to be inoperable. They knew where every missile was. They knew exactly what needed to be done, and they could do it all from the air. Well, look what happened. They didn't know even where the Hezbollah headquarters were. They didn't get any of the top people in the government. They succeeded in knocking out launchers for some of the long-range missiles, but the missiles, I'll bet you, are still there, and all you have to do is build another launcher. And the short-range missiles just kept coming and coming and coming. And they finally then had to go in on the ground, and that turned into a disaster, because it turned out that Hezbollah was far better prepared to fight on the ground than they thought they were. Now, if you want to multiply that times 100, put it on Iran, because you're going to have to go through the same process. Your initial bombing run will knock out some targets, absolutely. But it's not going to knock them all out. And a couple of things are going to happen. First of all, Iran will leave the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which it now is a member of. It will kick out the inspectors of the International Atomic Energy Agency, which are only eyes and ears, basically. We've got people actually in the big hall where they have their 164 centrifuges currently running. There are IEA inspectors in the hall with cameras on these things watching what they do. They would be gone. And then Iran, which today says, absolutely, we are not trying to build a bomb, would say, oh, well, forget that. We're going to go for a bomb, and we're going to go underground, and we'll see you later. And then what do? You keep bombing? What do you bomb? Israel finally ran out of targets. They didn't have anything left to hit, and things were still going. We'll get to that point, too. And then you've got to think about troops. Iran makes Iraq look like a picnic in comparison of size, the nationalism of the people, the natural defenses, on and on and on. This is an organized enemy. They taught Hezbollah. And if you look at what Hezbollah did to the Israelis, who, after all, had spent 18 years living in southern Lebanon and had air cover every single day, you have to ask what our chances would be going into Iran. And, you know, I think the administration has done that calculus, and they've looked at it. They don't want to say that they've come to this conclusion, but I think the conclusion is pretty obvious, that it's basically, among other things, the only way you would ever really resolve this to get the kind of troops that we would need, the numbers, you'd have to go to a draft. And if you really want to have trouble in this country, and you really want to have an anti-war movement, I recommend that to you as a way of getting there. So from my point of view, I think it isn't very likely that the administration will do it. But let me tell you why I worry about it just a little bit, and that is that since we are at this, you know, face-to-face, eyeball-to-eyeball situation with Iran all the time, and each side yammering at each other, making threats and the like, and not talking to each other at all, we are at risk of finding ourselves with a sudden surprise that something happens, some incident takes place, and it starts escalating up. There's an unexplained bombing at an American embassy, and people think that it's Iran that did it, and it wouldn't be hard to believe that. Or something else happens, and you can't really predict these things. And at that point, it's very hard for a government that has been talking about being tough on Iran to say, well, we're going to just let that pass, that we can't do any. They're going to have to do something. So there is a chance, and that's just as true on the Iranian side, that they would feel that they needed to respond in certain instances. So the chance of an escalatory spiral is always there, and that does worry me, that there will be a sort of a war that neither side really wanted and neither side was really quite looking for. Though both sides were talking war, they didn't really want it, and this is what they came out with. So that's my good news and bad news, I guess, as far as it goes.